Good afternoon. I'd like to firstly thank John Bell for lending me his stage this year. It's very good of him. In 2007, aging German playboy Rolf Eden filed charges against a 19-year-old for refusing to sleep with him. 77-year-old Eden has filed suit against a 19-year-old Berlin woman because despite a night on the town with Eden, which ended back at his place, she refused to sleep with him, saying that he was too old for her. That was shattering. No woman has ever said that to me before, said Eden. I was crushed. He's filed charges with the prosecutor's office. He said, after all, there are laws against age discrimination. It's a matter of justice. He went on to point out that even serving his 19-year-old date quality champagne and playing the piano for her didn't help. There are a few years between us, the 77-year-old admitted. And there are some women who are too old for me. But in that case, you have to be more diplomatic and say, sorry, you're not my type. According to Rolf, then, refusing to sleep with someone because of their age is an issue of justice and an issue for legislation. So welcome to the seminar on Justice is Not Christian. If you want to, it's not tricky to find a great deal of rather ridiculous stories about the abuses to which our legal system is subjected. Many of them come from the USA, but I thought I'd start with a German one, because now that you've elected Obama, it's okay to be American again. We've missed you. Welcome back. If you want to know what happened in that court case, I'm afraid I don't know. I've Googled desperately, but I have no idea what the verdict was. What does that have to do with what I'm going to say? Not a lot. But the story does at least illustrate some of the strange ways in which the concept of justice, particularly regard to the justice system and criminal justice, has been bent and abused in order to get it to mean anything and justify everything. But that's not what I'm going to talk about. The title of this seminar is actually serious. I'm not trying to suggest that the word justice has become so warped by popular lawsuits that it's not a Christian concept. I want to ask the more serious question, which is what we mean by justice and our practice of justice in Christian ethics, is that really Christian? Is the notion and practice of justice a good basis for our Christian ethics? In particular, coming from Christian Aid, I want to ask about justice in the context of global poverty and global development, and look at justice not so much as a theoretical or abstract concept, but as a lived example of what development agencies actually do. I want us to think about justice as a verb, the pursuit of justice, if you like, and ask practical questions about whether the things we undertake in the name of Christianity are really good ethics and good practice. And I hope what I mean by that will become clear. My name's Nigel Vandell. I actually work as the interfaith manager at Christian Aid. I spend a lot of time talking ethics with rabbis and Islamic scholars, sometimes even Christians. In spite of that, I have to say I'm not a theologian. I have no formal training in the subject, and I'm not a professional ethicist, which, this being Greenbelt, makes me perfectly qualified to speak to you. Let me just wrap out briefly what I'm going to say. First, I want to outline to you some of the situations that get development agencies to talk about justice, the reality on the ground, if you like. Then I'm going to look at some of the biblical injunctions for justice and calling us to act justly. Then I'm going to do the tricky bit, which is to question whether or not I've made a solid case for justice, and if it's as clear-cut as it first appears. I'm going to look at the methods that development agencies use to try and create or restore justice and see whether or not what we actually do can really be considered Christian. Finally, and this may be even more contentious, I want to consider if there are situations in which the pursuit of justice is actually the wrong thing to do, and whether or not Christians have an ethical basis for what they might do in those circumstances. At the end of that, what I'm going to do is bow. You're going to applaud and cheer because this is being recorded. My mother will get a copy, and please don't upset my mother. If we're going to be talking about justice, what I thought we'd do is look it up in a dictionary to define it first. It was very helpful. It said justice, the quality of being just. Which is very accurate, but I felt not entirely helpful for our purposes. But if you look up a lot of definitions, what you get are two terms that come up regularly: fairness and equity. So when I talk about justice in the rest of this seminar, those are the words I'm thinking of in my head. Is this fair? Are people being treated with equity? Let's start with a practical look at justice. I want to start by telling a story about the kind of injustice that gets on the nerves of agencies like Christian Aid. Wilson Manuba is a 30-year-old fisherman and father of three. He lives in a remote corner of the Calancan Bay on the Philippine island of Marinduque. Much of the island, its soil and its waters have been turned into a toxic wasteland that's dangerous and unfit for human use. The Marinduque government and many citizens are now locked in interminable legal battles with multinational corporate entities that came to take the copper out of the ground, but with it took away the people's environment, their health, their food, and their livelihoods. Wilson lived at the end of a rusty pipeline which from 1971 to 1996 channeled toxic chemicals and mining waste from the open pit mine in the mountains down to the sea. During that time, heavy metals like arsenic and lead, byproducts of copper mining, were dumped daily into the land and into the fishing grounds. Slowly and stealthily, it poisoned their lifeblood. The fish, the soil, the crops, the water, and then them. In 2002, Wilson lost one of his legs to the cancer caused by heavy metal contamination. He'd become infected with chronic arsenic poisoning. A fisherman since he was 7 years old, he'd also lost his main means of earning a living because the fish stocks of the Calancan Bay had been destroyed by the pollution. As the pressures of poverty and disability piled up, he also separated from his wife. He's recently learned that the cancer is back and he may lose his other leg. Just to add insult to that injury, according to the Christian Aid partner MAKEK and the provisional government, since 1996 to the present day, the mining company involved has failed to pay $20 million in provisional to the provisional treasury in local property taxes. Tax money that could have funded a health service that would have looked after Wilson. Is this just? Is this fair? Is this equitable? We know it's not. There's a natural human outrage at this kind of injustice. It makes us all angry without the need to do any serious theology to analyse it. This kind of scenario is what causes agencies like Christian Aid to talk and to rage about injustice. What we have here is a situation of inequity, of unfairness. A situation with a great disparity in power relations between a mining company that can act with impunity, poison the environment, destroy livelihoods, and then dodge taxes, and an indigenous population that has no recourse to measures that can make the company respect their human rights. It seems ridiculous that in that kind of situation, I'm going to suggest that justice might not be a Christian response. The worst thing is, of course, that there are a million and one stories that I could have called on. They're not hard to come by. When it comes to talking about justice, then, and injustice, Wilson has to be the acid test of any argument I make today. Whatever ethical approach I come up with, if it doesn't make a difference to Wilson, then it's not good enough. Then it's not Christian. So having had a quick look at that, let's take a step back and then think about what the Bible says actually about justice. Bearing in mind you're at a Christian Aid seminar and you're a green belt, I'm not expecting any of this to be particularly contentious. I'm not expecting this to come as a big surprise. So let's just skim quite quickly over it. First, God delights in justice. Proverbs 11:1. A false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but an accurate weight is his delight. Second, God commands that we study justice. Philippians 4:8. Finally, beloved, whatever is true, whatever is honourable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. then it's not enough to think about justice. We actually have to do justice too. Deuteronomy 16:20, justice and only justice shall you pursue. Micah 6:8, what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Not only is this justice for now, it's also our future hope. Jeremiah 23:5, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. If you didn't get down all of the biblical quotes, go and buy my CD. I only came 71st in the sales stakes last year. I want an improvement this year. Now, if you missed them, Proverbs 11:1, Philippians 4:8, Deuteronomy 16:20, Micah 6:8, and Jeremiah 23:5. You knew all of that. You didn't need me to tell you that God delights in justice, commands us to do justice, and holds out justice as a promise for the fulfillment of God's role in the future. There's no doubt that the Bible endorses justice. So where are we up to? So far, we've established that justice is a biblical concept, and that injustice can and does result in quite appalling and shocking harm to humanity. It can lay waste to people's lives, people like Wilson in the Philippines. It's something we find distinctly appalling and shocking. Now we're going to have a brief pause because, having discovered the website for the most outrageous court cases of all time, I thought I'd share another few gems with you just to let you catch up. So let me indulge you in two quick favourites. During the 1990s, quality example of justice in action, Budweiser ran a series of adverts where two beautiful women appeared in the front of two truck drivers drinking the brew. Michigan man Richard Overton promptly bought a case of the beer, drank it, waited, and no women miraculously appeared. So, like all good Americans, he sued. Overton cited deep emotional distress and mental injury due to false advertising and asked for $10,000 in damages, saying that false advertising would continue to compel him to buy beer in the hope of discovering hot women. Unsurprisingly, he lost, not just the case of beer, but the court case too. But for sheer creativity on justice as a Christian issue, my favourite has to be the man who sued himself. In 1995, Robert Lee Brock, a prison inmate in Virginia, claimed that the crime he committed while drunk had violated his own civil liberties and religious beliefs. The penniless prisoner sued himself for $5 million. Why? Well, the theory is that if he won as a prisoner with no source of income, the state would be forced to step in and pay the damages. So the state would have to pay him $5 million because he violated his own religious beliefs. I say creative genius, entirely wrong, and he lost. So a brief pause, but let's get back to the question. Why is justice not Christian? I'm going to come at this from a slightly different angle, so bear with me. I want to start not now by talking about what justice is, but asking what poverty is. If you read the literature, the academic literature on this, poverty tends to be defined in a very multifaceted way. It's not just the lack of money. It's about a lack of housing, education, lack of a job, lack of opportunities, lack of advancement, lack of choices, an inability to control your own life. Why do people become poor? Well, for a whole host of reasons. It might be a case of natural disasters, drought, famine, just plain bad luck. But more often not, the kinds of disasters that people are faced with are not natural, but humanly constructed. It might be that people are victims of war, that they're deprived by an economy that won't give them a fair wage for their labour, that won't allow them to have a job in the first place. They may be able to produce goods but not be able to sell them as they don't have access to markets, or find that they're undercut by subsidised goods from the developed world that are then dumped in their country. Whatever the reason, one of the key things to notice that in all of these instances of poverty, they happen because people share a characteristic, and that's one of weakness. Not an intellectual weakness that can't answer the problems of poverty or find a way out of their situation. Not a spiritual weakness that lacks that capacity to endure. For often the poorest people are among the world's most resilient. It's not a weakness in terms of initiative or determination. The weakness of the poor is a lack of that fundamental ability to control your own lives. It's a lack of power. And at its heart, that's the most significant cause of poverty. It's about politics and the politics that places a great deal of power in the hands of some and very little in the hands of others. It's that disparity in opportunity, that inequality, that unfairness that we call injustice. It's that injustice that is at the heart of poverty. So having gone through that detour, let's get back to the central question. What's the problem? Why is justice not Christian? Well, if poverty is a symptom of an unjust ordering of power relations in a society, and if poverty and injustice are contrary to the will of God, what's the claim I'm trying to make? I don't want to look at technical solutions to poverty here. I'm not going to talk about aid or debt relief, but start thinking more specifically about how it is we redress imbalances of power in relationships. And what I want to suggest is that development agencies like Christian Aid have two basic strategies for doing this. One of them is working in solidarity with the poor, and one of them is strengthening the poor. What do I mean by working in solidarity? I guess what I'm thinking about is the kind of campaigning work that you do with Christian Aid. The kind of thing you've done if you've gone into the Christian Aid venue, this greenbelt, and had your video made for Gordon Brown. What happens when we work in solidarity with the poor is that we lend the power that we have to them, to the causes that the poorest most want addressed. We effect a kind of temporary transfer of power so that we can force change from those that hold power. So when we join a Make Poverty History March, we lend our power as citizens in a democracy to the poor. When we engage in product boycotts, or we buy fair trade products, what we do is we lend our financial power to the cause of the poor. When we take shareholder actions in companies, we lend our financial and our democratic power to the poor in an attempt to coerce change. What it doesn't do is change the basic power relationships. It just shifts it round temporarily. The second thing we tend to do is a bit more radical. Strengthening the poor so that they actually have an opportunity to take what is theirs and not have to rely on the charity of the rich. It's a process that circumvents the need for our intervention because the poor now have power in their own right and don't need us to loan it to them. That process of empowerment doesn't necessarily mean we're talking about armed resistance. That's a debate I don't want to get into here. But it does mean transferring power, and there are a whole series of ways in which we can do that. One of those, for instance, is about education. One significant way in which the poor are marginalized is a lack of education. People who are unable to read and write and do simple arithmetics are ripe for exploitation. But we need to think about education as a much wider concept than that, too. We need to think about education in the principles of democracy, in voter rights, in human rights. What are the skills we can give to the poorest communities to help them access power? Let me give you a very concrete example of what that means. In Israel, in the occupied Palestinian territories, one of Christian Aid's partners there, Bet Salem, gives out video cameras to Palestinians so that they can record the abuses of their human rights that happen on a regular basis, either at the hands of militant settlers or at the hands of the Israeli army or police force. That record of human rights abuse then allows court cases to be brought against the violators of human rights or humanitarian law. The quality of the video evidence often isn't actually that great, and indeed many of the cases don't achieve a guilty verdict, but the simple fear of a court case against you has had quite a level of impact on the violence that's seen in places like checkpoints. What the cameras have done is given back power to individuals who have them. People have been marginalized from power. Indeed, I'd go further and say that one of the key things for digital technology will be the way in which it redresses power imbalances in the future. Think about the mobile phone footage out of Iran recently. Think about the mobile phone footage in the London riots, and you can begin to see the potential that has. It's that redressing of power that's allowed a certain amount of justice to creep into an otherwise exploitative system. It's about giving people power to enforce the rights that are theirs. Now I think you might begin to see the point I'm trying to get at. In both examples above, what we're aiming for is really a kind of sub-Christian ethic, and it's sub-Christian in its methodology and in its endpoint. Let's think about methodology. It's very clear that the Bible talks about an end to poverty and an end to justice. In biblical language, we look forward to the coming of God's kingdom, the new heaven and the new earth, where there will be no more hunger and no more thirst, where humanity flourishes. But the way the Bible talks about achieving this balance has nothing to do with a system of justice that relies on strengthening the poor. The balance of power in biblical terminology is about redemption. It talks of forgiveness and sacrifice as the ways of achieving these things. It looks to the example of Jesus, who emptied himself of power and became obedient to death on a cross, as an ethical pattern for our lives. If we're serious about looking for a biblical way to end poverty, then we must start looking for a method that doesn't rely on strengthening the poor in order for them to be able to take what is theirs, but a method surely that looks to the redemption of the rich so that they will open up their fists and allow their power to be diminished. As I've said above, the tools that redemption relies upon are forgiveness and sacrifice. What do I mean? Well, forgiveness requires an ability not to judge people based on our experience, but to treat them the same regardless of our assessment. What that might mean is the ability to accept even bad characters as possible partners in the quest for justice. In practical terms, it means assuming that the mining company that pollutes the water in the Philippines and takes away our lives might not be unremittingly evil, but can be forgiven and re-engaged in a struggle for justice and a better world. There are no companies, no governments, no institutions that are entirely beyond redemption and whom we can never forgive. Redemption, biblical redemption, is at its heart an optimistic view of human nature. Sacrifice is about a certain readiness to be vulnerable. When playing safe might seem like a better option, it takes risks. It's generous in its treating of other people and the way it uses its own resources. In the Christian tradition, it's that generosity that ultimately allows or demands that we go to a cross. It's that generosity that might allow the victims of injustice to move beyond retribution to redemption. I have to say that neither forgiveness or sacrifice feature too much in some of the models of ethics that Christian Aid comes across. The options of strengthening the poor and working in solidarity with the poor fail to be a purely Christian ethic. They seem, as I suggested, a bit sub-Christian. And if the methodology is problematic, then the outcomes are tricky as well. The kind of ultimate end that we're aiming for involves a world of uneasy confrontation, where strength matches strength and we keep each other at arm's length in a kind of nervous standoff. What we seem to achieve is not a Christian vision of the best of all possible futures, where there is a new heaven and a new earth, but one where we avoid the worst of all possible scenarios. It's an option where peace and justice are secured by balancing different interests so that no one can really get the upper hand. It's not really the peace we dreamt of, or the justice that the Lord requires. The options of strengthening the poor and being in solidarity seem to have a lower opinion of human nature. They assume that people will act out of the worst of their motives rather than the best. It seems to pay little attention to notions of Christian theology where people are made in the image of God and that people can respond creatively and generously to situations of injustice and poverty. by any stretch of the imagination on that evaluation and that analysis, the practical methods of seeking justice are sub-Christian. Justice is not Christian. So is there anything I can say to defend Christian Aid's strategy before I get sacked? The first thing to say is, although notions of equalizing power don't seem to take seriously the possibilities of humanity surprising us with generosity and self-sacrifice, I think they do take very seriously the theological notions of the fallen nature of humanity. That's also in Christian theology. We're mortal, we're sinful, we have to recognize that this means we are also capable of doing truly awful things. A brief look at human history shows us that assuming the best of people is not always a good strategy for ensuring that people will flourish. Justice does not seem to come when we leave it up to the powerful to give up their power and hope that they will do the right thing, and Wilson in the Philippines will tell you all about that. The second point to make is to look at the difference between the way that people and institutions behave. It does seem that the capacity of individuals for generosity and self-sacrifice is greater than that of institutions. It's an observation Niebuhr made in the 1930s, or if you weren't around in the 1930s, Walter Wink has also talked about the character of institutions, and relates that to the principalities and powers of biblical discourse. Why is that so? Well, one of the purposes of groups to coalesce in the first place is to preserve the interests of members of the group. The church may be an institution set up for the benefit of its non-members, but it's a pretty rare case. What that means is that groups tend to behave in selfish ways. Individuals in groups may have idealistic aspirations, but the actual activities of any group are mainly determined by their common interests, not their highest aspirations. Ethics gets dragged down to the lowest common denominator. That's not to suggest that institutions are evil or that individuals who work for them are. That's nonsense. But it does suggest that group dynamics can often result in a much poorer set of ethical outcomes than we might observe if we had exactly the same group of individuals acting on their own. So where have I got to with the argument? I think what I've argued is that injustice is born in disparities of power, in inequities of opportunities. The kind of injustice is what drives and fuels the poverty that organizations like Christian Aid are committed to fight. So the quest for justice is in some sense a very Christian quest. It's an ethical approach. But what I've also tried to argue is that the tools that we use to seek justice and only justice fall short of the aspirations we should have as Christians. What we espouse and what we practice is often a sub-Christian ethic that achieves results that kind of approximate a Christian vision of how the world should be but don't create it. The ethics, the morality of shaping a world where power is held in balance is not really Christian, because our Christian ethics are on forgiveness, generosity, grace, love. So we end up in a situation where the theoretical principle of justice might be something we can affirm, but the practice of justice in the real world falls short of something genuinely Christian. The justice that we seek will only come with a new heaven and a new earth. That will only come with God. It's somehow less than the sum of our dreams and visions. Justice, as Niebuhr once defined it, is the political economy of love. That's quite a chunk of theology. We're going to take a deep breath and have another quick look, time out, at some of our finest cases of justice. When Roy Pearson's neighborhood dry cleaner misplaced his trousers, he demanded compensation. This is only fair. And as you can imagine, for losing a pair of trousers, he demanded financial compensation. One pair of trousers, $65 million. He claimed mental suffering, inconvenience and discomfort, and that the satisfaction guaranteed and same-day service steins in the dry cleaners actually represented fraud. Luckily, Pearson, who, interestingly enough, was a judge, was not actually presiding over his own case because he lost his trousers, the case, and his job as a judge. But finally, I'm going to end with one cautionary tale. If you just think all of these mad court cases are going nowhere, let me just tell you one last one. Music publishers for the late avant-garde composer John Cage sued Mike Batt for plagiarism in 2002. They claimed that Batt's song, A Minute's Silence, ripped off Cage's 4 minutes 33 seconds, which also contained absolutely no music or vocals. Even though copywriting silence might seem difficult, Batt agreed to settle the court out of case by paying a six-figure sum. You want to know if silence is golden? Yes. So let's get back to the so what question. If in fact it's inevitable and realistic that development agencies have to act in ways that aren't entirely Christian, does it actually matter? Do we learn anything useful from this kind of analysis and this kind of thinking about development work? Before drawing a hasty conclusion, I want to look at one possibility where the pursuit of justice, as I've kind of outlined it here, might not be the right thing. My fear is that on some occasions we make the mistake of placing justice at the centre of our ethical vision. We fail to recognise that that justice that we place in the middle and that we can enforce is actually only a pale imitation of what justice should look like and should be in the divine realm. And so we place centrally a notion of justice that isn't genuinely Christian, and then we can get our ethics wrong. So what I want to do is remind everyone that the pursuit of justice as I defined it in this talk is not the central Christian ethic. And therefore, if the pursuit of justice in those frameworks doesn't lead to the right result, we can in all good consciousness abandon it and act out of love instead. So what am I thinking about? Situations I think that can cause problems are conflict situations. In effect, when the balancing of power has not just ended up in confrontation, but in conflict. I'm going to assume, I'm not going to argue it now, that the best solution from a Christian perspective is that in such circumstances, what we need is peace and not a continuation of conflict. Question is, how do we achieve peace? That's a complicated question with no simple answer, but let's unpick it a little more. There are two specific issues I want to mention, both again related to how we view justice and the pursuit of justice. First, conflict exists because someone's getting something out of it. Conflict exists because someone somewhere thinks they will gain territorially, financially, ideologically. So in order for conflict to cease, peace needs to be seen as the better option than the continuation of conflict to those in power. The problem here is that when conflict ends, what happens to the people involved? If we look at some of the existing conflicts that are going on in the world, we know that combatants on both sides have been accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Following on from the recent invasion of Gaza, for instance, both Israelis and Palestinians have been accused of war crimes. In situations of conflict, then, where our sense of justice wants those people who have been accused of crimes to be tried and, if guilty, then sentenced, here we have a notion of justice about the punishment of past wrongs and a deterrent for future wrongs. Surely that must be a good thing, right? But the question is, by insisting on that justice, do we create a situation in which the incentive for the continuation of conflict is now real? If individuals know that at the end of the conflict, they're going to be liable under international law for war crimes, then where is their incentive to end the conflict and hand themselves over? Surely they're signing their own arrest warrant. And there's an additional problem with conflict and justice. We know from research that the most vulnerable places to conflict are those areas where conflict has recently ceased. Why? Relapsing into conflict is really easy. Because for the very practical reason that everyone still tend to have weapons, and also because there often hasn't been a resolution of the underlying issues in the first place. In those contexts, the pursuit of justice where people are held accountable through a justice system and a balance of power is developed is not enough because the justice that we attempt to create is unlikely to result in peace or lasting peace. That simple focus on a single ethical issue can end up creating what some academics have called the tyranny of justice, something that perpetuates conflict situations. So what do we do in situations like this? What I want to argue is that we can move beyond situations of justice in conflict resolutions. In situations like this, using justice as our only measure might not be good enough. In situations like that, we have to move beyond it and start talking again about those issues we raised earlier about grace, about generosity, about forgiveness, those ethics that really centrally demonstrate Christianity. So if conflict is a context in which justice might not be the right response, how does that play out in reality? That's a very theoretical argument. What does that mean? Let me tell you a story from a Christian Aid partner that I think illustrates what I'm trying to get at. Let me tell you about Robbie Damelin. Robbie's a mother who lives in Tel Aviv. She's a member of the Parent Circle, Bereaved Families Forum, an organization funded by Christian Aid. Parent Circle consists of people from both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict who have lost a loved one. They meet together, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, who've paid the highest price in the conflict and yet refuse to condemn the other side. When everyone says there is no one else to talk to, they find people who in theory should be the least inclined to talk, and they talk to them. They don't talk about justice or retribution. They talk about forgiveness and generosity and redemption. If you hear Robbie tell her story, she points out that the sniper that killed her son David was arrested and imprisoned. Justice, in a sense, was done, but for Robbie it wasn't enough. She needed more. So she wrote a letter to the mother of the person that murdered her son. I'm going to read you her letter. "This, for me, is one of the most difficult letters I will ever have to write. My name is Robbie Damelin. I'm the mother of David, who was killed by your son. I know he did not kill David because he was David. If he'd known him, he could never have done such a thing. David was 28 years old. He was a student at Tel Aviv University doing his master's in the philosophy of education. David was part of the peace movement and didn't want to serve in the occupied territories. He had a compassion for all people and understood the suffering of Palestinians. He treated all around him with dignity. David was part of the movement of the officers who did not want to serve in the occupied territories, but nevertheless, for many reasons, he went to serve when he was called to. What makes our children do what they do? They don't understand the pain they're causing. Your son, by now having to be in jail for many years, and mine, who I will never be able to hold and see again, or see him married, or have a grandchild from him. I cannot describe to you the pain I feel since his death, and the pain of his brother and girlfriend, and of all who knew and loved him. All my life I've spent working for causes of coexistence, both in South Africa and here. After David was killed, I started looking for a way to prevent other families, both Israeli and Palestinian, from suffering this dreadful loss. I was looking for a way to stop the cycle of violence. Nothing for me is more sacred than human life. No revenge, no hatred can ever bring my child back. After a year, I closed my office and joined the Parent Circle, Families Forum, where a group of Israeli and Palestinian families who have all lost an immediate family member in the conflict. We're looking for ways to create a dialogue with a long-term vision of reconciliation. After your son was captured, I spent many sleepless nights thinking about what to do. Should I ignore the whole thing, Or will I be true to my integrity and to the work that I'm doing and try to find a way for closure and reconciliation? This is not easy for anyone, and I'm just an ordinary person, not a saint. I've now come to the conclusion that I would like to try and find a way to reconcile. Maybe this is difficult for you to understand or believe, but I know that in my heart it's the only path I can choose. For if what I say is what I mean, it is the only way. I understand that your son is considered a hero by many of the Palestinian people. He's considered to be a freedom fighter, fighting for justice for an independent, viable Palestinian state. But I also feel that if he understood that taking the life of another may not be the way, that if he understood the consequences of his act, he could see that a non-violent solution is the only way for both nations to live together in peace. Our lives as two nations are so intertwined. Each of us will have to give up on our dreams for the sake of the future of the children who are our responsibility. I give this letter to people I love and trust to deliver. They will tell you of the work we're doing and perhaps create in your hearts some hope for the future. I don't know what your reaction will be. It's a risk for me. But I believe that you will understand as it comes from the most honest part of me. I hope that you will show the letter to your son and that maybe in the future we can meet. Let us put an end to killing and look for a way through mutual understanding and empathy to just live a normal life free of violence. Robbie claims she's not a saint, but if you've met her, I might argue with her on that one. Justice, it seems, is not enough. It's not enough for Robbie. The arrest of her son's killer may be part of the process, but it's not enough. Robbie wants reconciliation. It's what we were talking about before. The generosity that, in spite of losing her son, refuses to give up the dialogue. The sacrifice that allows her to be genuinely vulnerable when most of us would retreat into our own comfort zones. This then, in practical terms, is what forgiveness and sacrifice looks like. This, from a non-Christian, surely is what a Christian response must be. Let me just quickly clear up one potential problem, and then we'll come to the conclusion. If our ethics are best when they're characterized by forgiveness and grace, then what sanctions are there in place to stop the unjust from doing as they please? The point of punitive justice surely is that it acts as a deterrence to further injustices. So if we remove this sanction, are we just creating a dictator's charter? They can do what they want, sure, in the knowledge they won't be held accountable. I hope that's not what I'm suggesting here. I'm not suggesting we ignore or replace the justice system. I'm suggesting we recognize its limits. It's not enough. There are places when it fails, and when if we're stuck in that framework of justice, we won't get beyond it. We need a bigger Christian vision of grace and redemption. Which kind of brings me to the end of what I'm trying to say. And here I guess I have to offer a bit of an apology, because I don't think there's a neat conclusion to the seminar. Having argued all around the houses about what we should be doing and how we should behave, there's no simple answer to the question. There's no simple formula I can offer to you that you churn in an ethical dilemma at one side and come out with an action at the other. Let me just try and pull together a few points. Justice is biblical, but the kind of justice that is envisaged here is idealistic. It involves the rich and the powerful divesting themselves of power so that they become equal with the poor and powerless. Justice and equity are achieved through redemption. The new heaven and new earth are obtained in reconciliation. Second, that's not the concept of justice that a development agency like Christian Aid, or indeed humanity, often pursues. It's beyond us to achieve that at most of the time. But that doesn't mean we can't achieve some kind of justice, some kind of balancing of powers that achieves an equity where people are not exploited, the powerless are not downtrodden, and the rich and powerful have to take account of all that they do. That's the practical work of justice that we do. Third, that vision is not really Christian. It's a sub-Christian ethic. The love that should form the highest Christian ethics is compromised by the reality of a fallen humanity when too often people act out not of the best of their intentions, but the worst of their selfish desires. The ethics we have to practice need to be realistic about human nature and our fallen selves. The justice we achieve, to repeat that quote, is the political economy of a love that is still beyond us. And finally, when we mistake human justice for divine justice, we place the wrong vision of ethics at the center of our practice. And that can get in the way sometimes of pursuing a genuinely Christian option. It's not enough. And if we set our sights that low, we can end up not solving the problem, but perpetuating it. What does that mean for Christian Aid? It means that the ethics business, there are no easy answers. In some situations, the best we can achieve is some kind of constraint on the powers of the rich to limit the damage that they can do to the poor. But it means that at other times, we shouldn't be surprised by grace. We need to recognize that in spite of our less than optimistic assessment of human nature, sometimes God breaks in and redemption comes. The powerful willingly give of themselves. And in such circumstances, the correct response is forgiveness and reconciliation. That may seem unlikely, if not impossible. But as someone famous once said, for mortals it's impossible, but not for God. For God all things are possible. And sometimes we will be surprised by God. The acid test, as I said at the start, is Wilson. What will make life better for Wilson in the Philippines? Well, there are probably two options. The most likely is that a court case will force the mining company to change their behaviour, to offer compensation for the damage that they've done, maybe even to help tidy up the pollution and offer new ways of earning a living. That's the option that Christian Aid partners are working towards. But there is another one, and that's that justice will be transcended by grace, that the company will offer to help the people of the island, and will end up not as an enemy whose power to be curbed, but as a partner for social change. And that might make for some very interesting and very uncomfortable relationships. What would happen if the polluting company offers to work with Christian Aid and help clean up their mess? Would we hold fast to principles of justice and say, no, we don't want to work with you, you must pay damages, it must be punished? Or would we forgive, not seven times, obviously, but maybe seven times, 70 times? Because that's a fuller expression of our ethics. And if we did, what would you, the supporter, think about Christian Aid's behaviour? Would you cancel your direct debit? Ethics are tricky and messy and difficult. There isn't really a clear answer at the end of this. We have to just do our best. But the aim of the ethics as a development agency must be to do what's best for the poor. And at times that might not be the same as what justice entails. We probably won't always get it right as a development agency either. And I think what we have to do is often assume the worst about people and plan for them to behave that way, but just sometimes get surprised by the best in people. We need to work not towards just an uneasy confrontation, but go beyond it to genuine reconciliation. Not just to empower the poor, but also to redeem the rich. At the end of the day, justice is not Christian, love is. And it's only love that will take us to the kingdom of God. Thank you. I have to go and introduce a film, but we have time for a couple of questions if you want them. You have to fight the breeze and try and make it up to this microphone here.
Thank you. I was just wondering if you could muse on a specific rather than a philosophical one that I've struggled with in the last few months. And that's the issue of Nestle. As someone who has boycotted Nestle, I am unsure as to whether I should now support the fair trade products that are coming out under their brand, or whether I should maintain my boycott because I still disagree with other areas of their policy. Where does the reconciliation come in, and at what point should I change my policy?
Yeah, someone's always said never take questions at seminars because the people that ask them are cleverer than you. Which is kind of, it's exactly the kind of issue we're talking about. And there must be, I mean, I think in theory, there must come a point where Nestlé's practices change. And we suddenly say, the question is, you're right, where is that balance? Where is the boycott, the action that will produce the behavioural change in Nestlé? And where do we change to engagement as being the moment when it will change? And I'd love to, as I say, give you an easy tipping point where you could say, right, all I have to do is add up these three criteria and it will change place. And I really don't know, and I don't know enough about Nestlé business practices at the moment to offer a firm conviction. But I do think there will come the point, I don't know if we're there yet, I still haven't eaten a Kit Kat in a while, where we will have to take Nestlé seriously and start buying their fair trade products if we can continue to force them through that process to do more. You know, if they take that as one and they stop improving, then you have to rethink it again. But if that buying stuff from them actually is the incentive to push them in the right direction, then that's the acid test. Are they getting better? How do we do it?
I've been thinking recently about justice and righteousness in the Bible. Very clear two different concepts, but in the Bible they're not the same word. Yeah. So what is it like to actually think without any separation of those two concepts?
I think what I was trying to draw is a distinction between what we humans can achieve as justice and what we call justice. And I think the basic problem, I think, for me when I think through ethics is often people say it's not just, as though that's the end of the argument, and kind of don't understand that when we talk about justice, we're talking about this funny sub-Christian thing, which is balancing power and forcing and coercing. And there are times when that's not the best thing. We need to move beyond that. We need to move into kind of more biblical view of justice and righteousness. So what I'm trying to do, I guess, is get us to think a little bit further than just saying, it's about justice, that's the end of the argument, move on. Is the justice that you're perpetuating there actually the biblical justice that we see in the page? And if not, can we go beyond it and find something else?
Thank you very much for that. I'm wondering, from the Christian point of view, how important you think it is whether justice is pursued in the interests of the person doing the pursuing or on behalf of a third party. I'm thinking that Jesus had a fair amount to say about justice for other people, but didn't defend himself at his own trial, if you call it that. Is that a significant difference to make?
I have to say that's something I hadn't thought of. I mean, basically in the seminar, looking at it again through that Christian Aid lens, I've been arguing about how we pursue justice, I guess, on behalf of other people. And not how we do it on ourselves. I guess if you create a genuinely Christian community or a genuine movement, then if I'm looking after someone else's justice, there's a good chance that someone is also looking after mine. And perhaps somewhere in that kind of debate, the argument about Christianity being a faith that is lived out in community and lived out amongst a wide variety of people is the way we deal with that, because it becomes a community responsibility to look after the justice, both of its members and its non-members, so that although I may not be looking after my own justice, someone else somewhere is, if that's helpful.
Thank you very much.
Well, if there's no more questions, we'll draw it to a close there. Thank you very much, Nigel.